views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
Good morning and welcome to this June 11th, 2014 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I will tell you more information on that in the second half hour. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone, and as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each and every week, we're here with authors to talk about craft, content, and the oh-so-mysterious writing process. It's my pleasure this morning to be joined by David Fuller, and in the second half hour, debut novelist Boris Fishman is here with me to chat about his novel, A Replacement Life. Of the more than 50 screenplays David Fuller has written, many of them have been made into movies or TV pilots. A handful of them even have his real name on them. Others carry his pseudonym. The ones with his actual name include Necessary Roughness, The Heist, and Gang in Blue. He also wrote and directed the Imagine-nominated short film The Ticket for Fox Searchlab. His first novel, Sweet Smoke, was nominated for an Edgar for Best First Novel by an American author, as well as being shortlisted for a John Creasy New Blood Dagger Award in Great Britain. It was a Discover Great New Writers pick for Barnes & Noble and an Original Voices pick for Borders. His latest is Sundance. It's a reimagined history of Harry Longbow, the Sundance Kid. It's published by Riverhead Books, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. David, hi.
Good morning, Marie. It's nice to be here.
Thanks so much for coming on. So tell us about Sundance. Tell us, for those who have not yet read it, and it's pretty newly out, so that could be the case, just kind of take us into the novel a little bit. Tell us about kind of the scope and depth of the novel.
Well, it's the story of the Sundance Kid who, in my version, was in jail under a pseudonym when he was supposed to have been killed in Bolivia. And when he gets out, he's sent his wife ahead to New York City, and they've been writing to each other every week for about 3 years. He's got 2 years to go on his sentence, and she stops writing him, and he doesn't know whether she's dead or alive. And when he comes out, he goes east to find her, and she's gone down the rabbit hole, and he comes up against the many things that are happening in New York at that time in 1913.
So where did the idea come from? Have you been a long Sundance Kid fanatic? Or tell me about what inspired it.
Well, I mean, I was 16 years old when the movie came out, so it was the coolest movie I'd ever seen. There's Paul Newman and Robert Redford, and they did something very unusual in that movie, which is they killed the heroes at the end. But and that you weren't really seeing in the movies. But really what happened was 20 years ago, I was in the backyard with my writing partner at the time trying to think up movies, and I came up with this idea of a Sundance Kid-like character who is in jail for like 12 years, and he comes out of prison, and a young punk decides to make his bones and tries to kill him, and the Sundance Kid-like character kills him in self-defense and knows that he's got to run, and he goes east and comes up against the Black Hand. My writing partner loved the idea. I was completely not interested in writing it because at that point I knew what it was. It was like a programmer, and it didn't seem to have any resonance. And he said, well, I'm going to write it. And I said, well, you go right ahead. Well, he never did write it, and these ideas come back to you little by little as time goes on, and one day I woke up and said, well, why is he a Sundance Kid-like character? Why isn't he the Sundance Kid? Which opened a door into, well, then he was in prison under an alias when he was supposedly killed, and this led to more things, but at the time I was writing other things. And I was in 200 pages into another novel when I realized that it was a love story because it was about Etta and him going after her, and I realized that my publisher at the time was going to hate the 200 pages that I was writing, and so I suggested this idea to my agent, and she loved the idea, so I abandoned that book and did this, which is why it was 6 years between books.
I love it. The one thing that struck me about this story is when I read it, you guys were in the backyard throwing a football around and tossing around ideas, and I thought, every writer needs that.
And the dog is lying on the ground thinking that it's a game for her, so every time we would drop it, she would grab it, and you get the drool on the ball, and you wipe it off on the grass. But there's a tactile sensation when you're throwing an idea back and forth, and it's got dog drool on the football.
Right. Yeah, I was thinking everybody needs that. Everybody needs a creative, inspirational type to stand in the backyard with you and toss a football around. And isn't that a great way to start generating ideas? Because you're kind of half focused on, whether you're going to catch the ball, and it kind of puts you into that flow state of mind where maybe ideas start coming.
I think that's exactly right. You need something to kind of keep you busy while the ideas are generating. And when you're working with a partner, it helps to be doing something together. I mean, you could go for walks together or whatever, but throwing the football was sort of our thing. And plus, it kept the animals involved.
Right, right. So what do you think it is? I mean, you know, Harry Lombau. Am I saying his name right?
Well, here's the thing about his real name was Harry Longabaugh.
Okay.
And I changed it on purpose, partly to make the character my own, but also because whenever I looked at it on a page, I always tripped over the extra syllable.
Yeah.
And it just didn't flow for me. So, and different members of his family pronounced his name differently or you know, had different versions of the name. And the Pinkertons actually called him Longbaugh. So I just allowed that to be my choice. It was a way of keeping him mine. So he was Harry Longabaugh, and I'll try and call him that as we talk about it, but in the book he's Harry Longbaugh.
Right, right. Yeah, and I love that distinction. I love that being able to make him your own and make his history your own, and yeah, that's a great concept. But I was wondering what it is about him, because he's such a enduring character. You know, he lived, 100 years ago. I feel like there are a lot of bad actors out there who make for fascinating characters, but there's something about him, and I'm trying to figure out what personality traits make a great character or a great legend that kind of keep coming back to us.
Well, it's a very interesting thing, because in reality, I don't think we would have known anything about Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid because they vanished, because they went to South America and they vanished. When people vanished, they kind of get lost, and really, in reality, I think it was 1935 before people were even talking about the fact that they were gone, and they sort of disappeared. The reason they came around is really because of William Goldman. He made this movie, and when Robert Redford was cast, I think that just sort of imprints an image of, you know, not just a handsome guy, but also a taciturn guy. He's laconic, he's, you know, and he's funny, and he's charming and a movie star, and it really captured our imagination. It's a terrific movie and a terrific performance. So I do think it comes from that. And in terms of writing the character, there's a combination of you're trying to write for a modern audience, you're trying to write of a particular time, which is 1913. So you're trying to do a stylistic thing to make people feel that they're in that time, but you also have a very strong image of who the Sundance Kid was through the movie. And because he was humorous and light and all these kinds of things, I wanted to try and bring in an element of that too in terms of working a character.
Right, right. I'd read somewhere that this book is much more appealing to the female audience than maybe the movie. Well, the movie had Robert Redford, so women were interested for that reason. But you were talking about the importance of the love interest and how much your editor loved that concept. And now it gives him a motivation to be, you know, moving around looking for this woman. Did that kind of enter into your equation, that this would now be appealing to the wider audience of women rather than just moving it into the Western, you know, fiction realm?
Well, initially it was the element of being interesting to me to write it. It wasn't until I realized that it was a love story that I became interested in it. And it wasn't necessarily because of the love story element of it, but because the love story itself had resonance to me as a storyteller. And I understood that I could embrace the whole piece, and that I knew that I was going into a realm that I didn't expect. When I thought it was just about a Sundance Kid-like character going to fight the Black Hand, it was like, well, so who's, you know, how has he come up against him? What's the point? It just seemed very flat to me. And bringing her in, it became part of his background that he was involved in it, and it allowed me to discover the story. In terms of it having just been a Western, I mean, I know that many people think this is a Western. I think of it more as historical fiction and romance, mm-hmm. but he's the Sundance Kid also, so there is a male audience, I hope, for that too.
Right, right, right. My guest this morning is David Fuller. The book is Sundance. And through the course of writing so many screenplays and a couple of novels, and some of the screenplays went on to be made into film, some didn't, Tell me about knowing when a project will work and when it's time to abandon something, when it's time to keep pursuing it, when it's time to come at it from a different angle. Is there a kind of stage into it that you have to get to figure out if it's going to work, and kind of what speaks to you to tell you keep going or stop?
Oh, Marie, you just never know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole, in fact, that's the whole William Goldman thing. Nobody knows anything. There are times when I sat down to write movies, you know, out of desperation, trying to figure out how to figure out the zeitgeist and get something that people were making, and those are the movies that nobody was ever interested in. When I sat down to write something that I was interested in, I thought, who's going to care about this, but I have to write this, all of a sudden people were, you know, calling and saying, this is great, I love this, let's make this, all kinds of stuff. Those weren't necessarily the movies that got made, but those are the ones that got the most attention and often got sold.
Right.
So you just never know.
And is it different between novels and screenplays where the threshold or something for getting it out into the world is higher for one than the other?
Well, it's such a different world, and I honestly didn't really know the publishing world. And I always saved the ideas that I thought were better or more important to try and write in prose, because I know what happens to, you know, a screenplay. I mean, basically, whatever you wrote, it isn't what's going to come out on the screen. You get way, way too much help. Everybody helps you. The studio executive helps you. The director helps you. The star helps you. And then you get fired, and then the next three or four writers change it. And when the lights go down and your name comes up, you cringe, because it certainly isn't the movie that you hoped it would be. But that's just kind of the way it is. And
right.
In terms of writing prose, I think I had a fairly skewed idea of what it was, because when I wrote when I wrote Sweet Smoke, it was 8 to 10 years of research. And when I wrote it, my mentor read it and basically said, "Well, you have a problem." I said, "What is it?" He says, "I have no idea who's going to read this because it's good." and then somehow people got excited about it, and I ended up having a chance to meet different agents who were interested in representing it. And it happened very quickly, so I had a very skewed idea of what it is like in publishing. This time around, I'm beginning to learn a little different.
Right. Right. So let's talk about research. You brought that up, something taking 8 to 10 years of research. I don't think this one... It couldn't have taken that long.
Because, one didn't take as long.
That's good. But let's talk about kind of knowing where to go, knowing when you've done enough, knowing what facts you can play around with, like his name, what facts you have to adhere to, and then, you know, finding your jumping off point. Talk a little bit about your research project and playing with research.
Well, first of all, I'm a great believer, and this was even in screenplays, that you try and get things right as much as possible. They may change later on because you have other writers coming in terms of screenplays, but I always tried to get it right. I figure that if you do your homework and you tell a story, you know, the truth is usually stranger than fiction in those cases. But particularly when it came to my own prose, I was very interested in getting it right. And the first book is told from the point of view of a black slave. And I'm not a black man, and so I really knew that I had to get it right. And I knew that I was going to take a number of years of research to make sure that I got it right. And what you end up on this path where you kind of run into things as you go along. I mean, I did a lot of the research here at my desk, partly because I really wasn't able to travel to, you know, young sons, and wasn't able to travel a lot to go to a lot of these different places. One of the interesting elements was my editor at the time said, "How did you get all this stuff going about the plantation?" And I said, "Well, I put it together from books and whatever I could put together, because I never got a chance to visit a plantation." And she said, "I find that very hard to believe, because I grew up on my grandfather's tobacco plantation, and you got it right."
Wow.
But you keep hoping you've done it. You know, you've got everything together, and that you haven't missed something major. And I was reading an article by Edward P. Jones, who wrote The Known World, and he talked about doing research for that book and how at a certain point he realized he just had to start writing, otherwise he'd reach for research for another 20 years.
Right.
And I kind of looked around and said, oh, gee, that's probably smart. And at that point, I put down my research and started writing, figuring whatever I needed along the way, I would find.
Right. Yeah, that's what I always wonder is, I mean, you could drown in research, and it's such a comfortable place for a writer to go because you're not actually having to write, right? You're getting to look stuff up. And
research is a trap, but I do love writing, and I love getting to it. And one of the interesting things about that particular book is I had 3x5 cards and everywhere, and I had all this information. And when I actually sat down to write it, I almost never went back to anything that I had written down. It was all in my head. And the stuff that I went looking for were things like, well, what are matches like in the Civil War? You know, what are envelopes like in the Civil War? That kind of thing. So.
Right. Well, I guess that makes sense because the stuff that would bubble up in your brain would be the same stuff that would be interesting to a reader. You know, the stuff that sticks is the stuff that's fascinating. And so it would make sense that those are the details that are going to make it into the book. You kind of have your own filtration system just built into your own brain, right? Because it's interesting stuff. Like the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. Tell us a little bit about researching that because I'm so drawn to that point in history. There's been a couple of novels written about it. What drew you to that piece of history?
Well, again, it was prevalent to the time, of course, and it was changing everything in New York City. There are those who say that it led to the New Deal, but it did certainly change how people looked at workers, and this is one of the elements that I wanted Etta to be involved in because I wanted her involved in the women's movement and in the ILGWU. This is the early version of that. And how the women were the strength in terms of the union, and it really begins there. In terms of research, I read as much as I could about it, but also these are the kinds of things that you also go looking sometimes for videos, DVDs, stuff like that, so you can actually see pictures. It becomes almost more important to see the visual. And when I got a hold of the New York Times from the day after, it was so amazing how they reported it and how visual and what a punch to the gut their reporting was. It, you know, I actually quoted from them because I was so impressed by it.
My guest this morning is David Fuller. The book is Sundance, a reimagining of the ending of the life of the Sundance Kid. So you had said you thought you could research and write this book in a year, and then you said I was wrong. It took 3 years. Talk a little bit about the gap. You know, what came up to surprise you maybe in the writing process, maybe the more difficult challenges that came up in the book, and what kind of attributed to the two-year gap from expectation to reality?
Well, the two-year gap from expectation to reality is pretty easy because I had sons who were playing baseball. And I needed to get them to the field, and I was just there. I really love being there when they're playing and to see them and to be with them. So there was that element. Plus, we were having our house worked on, and my office was outside the house, and so we moved out, but I came to my office every day, and my contractor, who was a lovely man, used to come and knock on the door and say, "Now, Dave, would you come and take a look at this?" And 3 hours later, I'd come back to work. So there was a certain amount of that just got in the way, but I'm not sure that that's not a good thing in the sense that sometimes it takes a while for the story to really gel, and it may have needed that period of time also. I think if it was really ready, I probably would have said, "No, I can't talk to you right now. I'm writing."
Right.
So there's that element. The other thing, one of the things that happened during the writing was I came across a book called Digging Up Butch and Sundance, in which Ann Meadows and her husband were interested in finding the bodies of Butch and Sundance in San Vicente, Bolivia. And when they did finally get permission to dig up the bodies, they didn't find them. They found a German soldier named Gustav Zimmer in the place where they were supposed to have been buried. So it's a question as to whether it was really them or not. And if you look at some of the documents of the time, they're never mentioned by name. It just talks about the two Yankees, and the different versions are, you know, not everybody tells the same story. I mean, eyewitness accounts are notoriously untrustworthy, but nevertheless, it's certainly possible that it wasn't them.
Did you say the grave was dug up after you started writing the book?
No, it was dug up in 91. I didn't know about it.
Okay.
Until I was writing the book, at which point I got a chance to write this little foreword, which which is sort of amusing, just about how, hey, maybe this is true.
Right, right. Yeah, I often ask writers if something happened along the way to kind of give them the nudge to say, yes, you know, some force of the universe coming down and saying, you're doing the right thing, you're on the right track. I know this is a long, arduous, hard, uncertain process, but you're doing it right.
You never know, but at that point, it wouldn't have made any difference one way or the other because I was deep into it and moving forward, but it was kind of nice to have it.
Very nice to have it. Very nice to have it. Did you learn anything through the course of this that surprised you, either about kind of yourself as writer or about the storyline that was particularly surprising to you, or what kind of was revealed to you as writer when you were writing the book?
Well, one of the things is there are always surprises that come along. I mean, you know where you're going, you know your destination, or at least I do, I have a pretty good idea of where the story is going to end up, but I like to leave things open because the subconscious has been, once you've done your homework, the subconscious takes over and starts to put things together, and I discover them while I'm writing sometimes. And while there's a spoiler alert that I'm not sure, because many people haven't read it, I don't know if I want to give it away, but there was something in the book that I had thought about putting in, decided not to, and when I got there, I just wrote it. And when it was done, I said, yeah, it needs that. And it needed it because it was through a stretch where the story had gotten a little bit grim, had gotten a little tough, things were happening, and when this thing happens, it lifts the mood of the main character, and then lists the book, and from that point on, you can move into the ending. Mm-hmm. Did I do that without giving anything away?
Yeah, you did.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
Very good. Very good. So good. Do you approach novel writing similarly to screenwriting? Do you bring those skills to bear on this in terms of like structure, the three-act structure, or I'm sure dialogue? It's very visual. The dialogue is fantastic.
Thank you.
Do you find your screenwriting skills bolstering your novel skills, or are they really very different?
I do think that it's often very good. I think it would be very good for many novelists that I have read, and not all, but many novelists that I've read, to write screenplays in the sense that you really must tell a story very quickly. You have 120 pages. It's approximately a minute a page. There's not much chance to do anything but get that character established immediately and in motion. You have to go with it. The joy, of course, of writing a novel is you get to step inside their head. You get to do things differently. But I like the propulsiveness of screenwriting, and I think that it helps me, at least, in terms of storytelling. There are times when I have to slow myself down, and I'm happy to slow myself down in terms of storytelling. But other times, I like that, and I think it's good. I like, you know, I don't necessarily work in a three-act structure, but knowing it, I know when to break those rules.
Mm-hmm. Do you read it aloud? Do you read the novels aloud to get an ear for the dialogue or for the prose?
I don't, actually. I think I'm a better actor in my own head than I am, you know, than I am live. So it, you know, I would say that the actors that I've worked with over the years have always liked my dialogue because they feel comfortable with it in their mouths. So that may be an element to it. But in terms of the visual element of the stories, people say, "Oh, it's because you're a screenwriter." And I always say, well, in a screenplay, you're not really allowed to describe much because if you do, you'll make the director angry.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to hear, like, what you think it should look like because he's going to decide how to direct it. So he's like, get this out of here. Just, you know, I'll decide what it looks like. But I started as a painter.
Oh,
so
okay.
The visual element to me, I mean, I assume has more to do with that than it has to do with the screenwriting.
Right. It is amazing how different disciplines really complement each other. And even the conversations that I have with visual artists, all of their decisions are surprisingly the same as novel writing. You know, I mean, it translates different, but in terms of form and content and structure and balance and all of those things, they all ripple throughout all of the arts. So.
Absolutely. But one of the reasons that among the reasons that I stopped being a painter is that it's one image. It's, you know, the story is told in one image.
Yeah.
And I wanted to tell stories. I was interested in in finishing it somehow.
Right, right. Do you have advice on getting stuck, getting mired down, keeping on track? You've written so much. You're so prolific in all of the screen writings and the novel writings. It sounds like you have a separate office outside the house, which maybe helps keeping you structured and disciplined. But talk a little bit about writers keeping themselves on track.
Well, I don't really believe in writer's block. I think if you're not writing, it's because you need to go do more homework.
Hmm.
You know, the more you put in, the more you can kind of process, and the more then you're able to get out. And generally when I get stuck, it means, okay, you haven't looked at this long enough. You haven't spent enough time with this. You need to go back and review this or read this over here or look at this. I mean, and there are times when things aren't ready to be written just because you haven't processed it enough.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's writer's block per se. That's just my own take. I don't feel that I've ever really had writer's block. What was the other part of the question? I'm sorry, I got lost.
Just sort of keeping yourself disciplined and keeping yourself on track. If you give yourself deadlines, if you have tips
right.
and tricks on getting, you know, unplugging the internet, I don't know what they are, but.
Well, for me, generally, if I'm not writing at a certain point, and I think I should be, I usually trust the instrument. It's usually telling me, no, you just haven't worked out enough, you know, this process. Go out and garden or go out and walk around and you know, just let it happen. I try not to be impatient because there are times when the sort of subconscious is working out a story idea, and when it's ready, it just comes. And it comes usually pretty quickly, and depending upon the project, Sweet Smoke was written very much on a computer. Sundance was written by hand.
Wow.
It just wanted to be written on a piece of paper. I don't know why, but it felt like it.
And they didn't have computers in 1900, so.
Well, or in 1862.
Right, yeah, good point, right. Right. Or period. I'd love to end with you doing just a really quick reading from the book, just to give our listeners, you know, kind of access to what we've been talking about here.
I'd be delighted to. I have a piece where the Sundance kid meets Etta for the first time. And I'll begin.
Perfect.
When he first met Etta, she had been a schoolteacher. He had been impressed by her intelligence, knowing how limited opportunities were for smart women, particularly in the West. He thought back to the day they met. Etta had been astonished by him, this interesting, handsome cowboy, who also happened to rob banks and trains. Longbow wasn't astonished in the least. He had known her immediately, believing that he had met the right one. He wondered why she didn't know it, too. At the time, she had been engaged in a flirtation with a clever young fellow who was a teacher in a nearby town. Longbaugh thought the flirtation irrelevant, as chemistry was chemistry. But he did wonder why, for her, it came down to a choice between men rather than the thunderbolt it had been for him. That lack of perception on her part was the first warning sign, and he took a mental step back. The other man appeared to be the very model of civility and stability, too good to be true, and then he was indeed too good to be true as she discovered he was married. Even so, young Etta had managed to convince herself that, to be modern, perhaps a married man was what she was supposed to want. Longbaugh considered that a second warning sign and took another mental step back. By now, Longbaugh knew she was too young for him. Chemistry was not enough for him to lose his heart, and the thunderbolt did not saddle him with an emotional obligation. Surveying her with a cool head, he acknowledged issues of timing and age compatibility. He rationalized now, thinking it was a great deal to ask, even of a mature woman, that a female member of polite society might commit to a man whose very name was associated with a life on the outside of that society. It was time to get on his horse and ride away fast. He was more than ready to do just that. He knew it was the wise move, and yet he did not. Something about her potential kept him there. But potential could only be fulfilled by time and patience, and that was not in the cards for a man in his occupation. So he pressed the matter and put her to the test, fully expecting her to fail. Recklessly, he took her to visit a bank in a neighboring town, not to rob it, but to show her how he might go about robbing it. He wanted to know her reaction. He parked their carriage off the main street. She was appropriately curious and excited as they approached the bank, and seemed to be taking in all the details, as if this was a one-time event, and she wanted to be sure to remember it all for her diary. Once inside, bad luck struck immediately, as he was recognized. He showed no panic, but Etta was anxious for him and wanted to get him away. Enjoying her display of nerves, he lingered to watch the whispered news of his identity pass from teller to teller. He was flattered to be recognized and further flattered to see her impressed by his fame. Finally, he led her to a side door to the hallway that would take them out through the back. But once away from bank employees and customers, she took his hand and pulled him toward the stairs. She wanted to go up. It seemed a questionable move, but he saw something in her eyes. He took a chance and again recklessly went along. Armed lawmen burst into the bank through the front, met a roomful of excited, wagging fingers pointing out the outlaw's escape route, rushed out the side door into the hallway, past the stairs, to the rear door, where they came face to face with more lawmen. Now on the roof, Etta led Longbaugh to the ledge, where it was but a small jump to the roof of the next building. As they leapt together, she jubilantly tossed her hat high in the air. It fell in the exact wrong place, dropping between the buildings all the way to the alley below. She looked at her hat two stories down in the dirt, and he heard for the first time that special laugh that he would later learn was just for him. She smoothed her hair, gathered in her mirth, took his arm, and soberly led him down the stairs into the general store. They went out the front door while the owner and his customers were glued to the big window, seeking a glimpse of the famous outlaw who had been recognized in the bank next door. She pulled against his arm to go back for her hat, but people were coming out now, and he met her eye with an almost imperceptible shake of his head. She immediately understood and went with him the opposite direction, across the street and around the corner to their carriage. No one noticed them right away. Etta was hooked, but so was he. Before they had entered the bank, when he thought she was simply trying to memorize the moment, she was appraising the landscape. She had seen that the roof of the general store was the same height as the bank, and the buildings had been built close together. She had formulated an escape plan when he hadn't imagined that they would need one. She was thinking more like the kid than the kid. From that moment on, they were together.
So great, so great. That was David Fuller reading from Sundance. Has anybody ever told you you have kind of a Rod Serling sort of voice? If the Twilight Zone comes back on, you can...
No, but thank you.
Be a great narrator for the Twilight Zone. Sadly, that is all the time we have, but David Fuller, thank you so much for taking the time.
Marie, thank you, and thank you for having me on your show.
It was a huge pleasure. That was David Fuller. The book is Sundance. It's out and available now. You can find David online and read more about him, his work, and his screenplays. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Debut novelist Boris Fishman will be here in the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back.
Reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. Or you can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I'm joined now by Boris Fishman. Boris was born in Minsk in the former Soviet Union in 1979 and immigrated to the U.S. in 88. His journalism, essays, and criticism have appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, and Book Review, The Wall Street Journal, and many others. He received a degree in Russian literature from Princeton and was on the editorial staff of The New Yorker. He edited Wild East, Stories from the Last Frontier, a collection of short stories about the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe in the early post-communist years. He received a Fulbright research grant to Istanbul, Turkey, and co-wrote and edited the U.S. Senate's report on Hurricane Katrina. Boris has his MFA in fiction from NYU, where he was a New York Times Foundation Fellow, and since then he has received residencies and fellowships all over the place. To support his writing, he has been a hiking guide, a farm laborer, a market researcher for a maker for a temporary concrete, editors, fact checkers, all kinds of things, all kinds of interesting jobs. A Replacement Life is out now from HarperCollins. It came out last week. It's a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers pick. It's his first novel. We'll chat about that and more this morning. Boris, hello.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Thanks for coming on. So tell us about A Replacement Life. Kind of take us into the novel's world for those who haven't read it and kind of tell us a little bit about the scope of the book.
Well, it's about a young man who, like myself, was born in the former Soviet Union, and like many of the people who came from there to here, settles in South Brooklyn with his family, only that he can't wait to get away because he feels stuck there for all the reasons that any immigrants will recognize. And so he cuts off all ties and runs off to Manhattan and just sort of waits for the Americanness to take hold. And, of course, it takes a little bit more than that to become an American. But he's lured back to the old neighborhood because his grandmother passes away. And he's filled with regret because he never really got to know the woman. So he comes back for the funeral, and his grandfather has a most underhanded, unsavory offer for him, which is that his grandmother is a Holocaust survivor and is eligible to apply for restitution from the German government. But in a bitter irony, she's passed away before she could. His grandfather says, "Why don't you write it about me instead?" And Slava, the narrator, says, "But you don't qualify. You were evacuated." And his grandfather says, "You're a writer, aren't you?" And it sort of goes from there.
So great. What inspired it? Tell me a little bit.
Well, what inspired it is that my real-life grandmother, who passed away 10 years ago, she was a survivor. And perhaps you know, but people behind the Iron Curtain weren't eligible to apply for restitution. These restitution agreements began to be arrived at as early as the 50s, but people in the Soviet Union, survivors, could not apply because it was felt that their government would poach the money, which was a reasonable thing to be concerned about. So she didn't become eligible until we got here in the late 80s. Who learns English the fastest in the family? The kid does. So even though I'm 15 years old by this point, which is the mid-90s, her paperwork, her restitution paperwork, was given to me. And even at that young age, it was very obvious to me, something really jumped out, which is the burden of proof was so low. For obvious reasons, if you were in the ghetto in Minsk, in Belarus, which is where she was, you weren't given any kind of confirmation voucher to prove down the line that you had been. So it sort of came down to how good a story you could tell about what you'd experienced. If you could tell a good story, you were in. It was easy in her case. It was all true. But it sort of got my mind going because I thought, someone is going to have a field day with these applications. And that sort of started my idea for the novel in the mid-90s. And I got a very dubious vindication. I started writing in 2009. A year later, a huge fraud was exposed in South Brooklyn where people got up to exactly what I'd imagined for the novel a year earlier.
Isn't that great? We were just talking about that in the first half hour, about how things come along for novelists to say you're on the right track, or, you know, I know this is a long, hard, arduous process, but you're doing the right thing. Like, the universe just gives you little signs. This was such a great one.
You know, it's a complicated one because when you're airing a community's problematic laundry, so to speak,
right.
a lot of people in your family and beyond
are very ambivalent about what you're doing. You know, to be Jewish in the Soviet Union was a very threatened kind of existence. It really was a second-class life. And as any such community will understand, you circle the wagons, and you certainly don't air the dirty laundry. So to have this act of exposure, it's complicated for people. And, you know, we think of Philip Roth, who was first vilified for what he was beloved for Goodbye Columbus, then he was vilified for Portnoy's Complaint, and ultimately crankily embraced as a representative of the community, so to speak. I'm certainly not comparing myself to him, but it's a difference of degree rather than kind. You're grappling with, I'm drawing a lot of material. I would not have the same kind of material if I didn't grow up the way I had. And so a lot of people, I can understand if they're of two minds about the way that material was used, you know?
Right. Good point. You did a great blog entry talking about this crossover between using autobiographical elements from your life and, you know, and then expanding them and obviously twisting them and creating fiction and creating something that kind of wholly new. And you had this great line, which was autobiography isn't a Confederate feeding you inside information. It's a friend looking to betray you. And how difficult it is to write sort of in the memoir form and being confined by the truth and then, you know, knowing where to jump off and what to keep sacred and what not to. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, about using some autobiographical elements and then and whether that made it easier for you or more difficult for you and then jumping off into the great fictive leap.
Yes, of course. Well, invariably both. I mean, I think the assumption among some people, and I won't even assume for others, until I wrote a novel with autobiographical elements, I myself, whenever I heard that a novel, you know, paralleled the author's life in broad strokes, I thought the question that immediately came into my envious, fragile writer's ego mind was, well, how much of this is autobiographical, meaning how much were they helped by things that really happened? But what I experienced as I was working on the book is that if it really happened in real life, it can lead you astray as often as help on the page. Sure, it's a useful kind of raw material, but it really has to be translated and finessed and distilled and warped and falsified in order to make for good drama. The thing that I always think about is if you create a transcript of real life, there is some good stuff in there. There's some genuine plot and character in there, but it's buried in really long stretches of meaningless, boring stuff. So in order to make it work on the page, you essentially have to falsify. And if it really happened to you, then you are disproportionately attached to it. The things that you think are incredibly meaningful and incredibly moving and incredibly touching, you can bet that others won't see it the same way. Another example is certain things are obvious to you, so you'll remember that you have to set them up and prime them in a more detailed way for readers who are not as acquainted with what it means to be from a community like this one. At the same time, it's not a nonfiction book. You can only explain so much. And so you get bogged down. You're essentially trying to take yourself out of your own psyche and place yourself in the minds of readers who did not have the experience that you had. So sometimes it really feels like, God, I wish I hadn't gone through any of this, so I was inventing out of whole cloth, you see? So in many ways, it does provide that raw material, but it also sets you back because it creates these incredible blinders.
Were you ever tempted to just abandon your grandmother and grandfather out of your mind and start with people who looked nothing like them, or would that have been too difficult?
You know, it's a really interesting question, and so much of the writing goes on in such a kind of trance, where I don't mean the muse touches down and something beautiful happens. I just mean you're so anxious and frantic and desperate to sort of put down something that works, that feels right, that feels resonant. But it makes me think of what people say about witnessing a car accident. It all became, it was so unreal, they say. It sort of feels like that. I actually have a hard time accessing what was in my mind as I was working. But one of the things that I do recall really standing out to me was, I don't know if this is arrogant, but my real-life grandmother was the source for some of these stories. But when I got on the page, for some reason, I never felt guilty or self-conscious about having a field day with her story and falsifying it with a real lack of conscience, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I think moral judgment of that, I didn't judge myself morally for doing that. It seemed essential to creating a good work of art. And even though she was gone by then, somewhere in my heart, I felt like she understood completely and would forgive me. Now, I paid a high price. Because now when I reread the novel, I'm often not sure what really happened to her in real life and what I made up. That's the cost. But, you know, when I go see her at the cemetery down in Brooklyn and we have our sort of chats, I don't know, maybe it's self-serving, but I can't help feeling like she forgives me and understands completely. We spoke entirely different languages when she was alive. And yet, for some reason, I feel like in some ways she understood me better than anyone in the family.
Isn't that funny? That's funny. My guest this morning is Boris Fishman. The book is A Replacement Life. I wonder if because your grandfather was still alive, if there was a point in the novel writing where you almost had to cut yourself off from these people so that you'd get their voices out of your head so you could move on with the, you know, with what had to happen on the page. And if the real life people were sort of crowding out or sometimes smothering what you were trying to do in the novel.
Well, that's a really good question because I should point out all the ways in which the novel is an invention. For example, unlike Slava, who cuts himself off from his former neighborhood, I never did. Uh-huh. And I always tried very hard to maintain relationships with my family. But what that means is that they are coming into your head and insisting on being real-life versions of themselves. And so you end up engaging in a kind of schizophrenia where you interact with them in real life as they are and do your best to allow them to be who they want to be. And then when you get onto the page, you give yourself absolute license to ignore everything that you experienced when you were interacting with them in real life and imagine them as entirely different people. You give them different names. You give them different physical characteristics. You make them do on the page things that they would never do in real life in order to begin to think of them as different people. Another thing that I think is very interesting that I read once from, I forget if it was Russell Banks or Norman Rush, but they talked about the real life versions, the real life models for the characters you create. They're so insistent. They want to get in there so bad. Okay, placate them. Give them a tiny role. They're the cashier at the grocery store. They check out the main character, and the main character goes out. That quiets them. That satisfies their ego, but it also gets them out of the way so you can get busy with the act of genuine invention.
That's fantastic. I love it. I love it. You said something earlier that you said it today, and I read you saying it before, so I'm taking it as really important. This notion that the things that are important to us in real life aren't important to other people, and the little details that happen to us are what are resonant with a greater audience. And I'm interested in that, in the sort of, you know, what is it that's universal about the human experience that literature is trying to convey, and what is so personal as to not be able to extrapolate to the human experience? I was thinking about dreams. I mean, nobody ever cares about listening to other people's dreams, but they're so important to the person telling them, right? And when you know what is important to you is not going to make the leap. Am I making any sense in this question?
No, absolutely. Yeah, you're referring to that blog post that I wrote about autobiography, and I mentioned that there. You know, Henry James said, tell a dream, lose a reader.
Yeah, right.
So I sort of took it as a personal challenge, and I have several dreams in the novel. Maybe I fail and lose readers in that way, but I had to try, you know?
Yeah, no.
If I had to boil down the difference between the Soviet experience and the American experience to one thing, it's when somebody says you can't, you know, a typically Soviet person says okay, and an American person says, oh really? And so if you want to ask me what it means for me to be someone who was brought to America at a very young age by my family, it's that. I read Henry James saying that, and I ran with it. But to answer your question, this is one of the trickiest things for me as a writer. I read recently, you know, there's a lot of writers talking about how you can't think about your audience. And that is absolutely, you have to write for yourself. And that is absolutely true, and that has been true for me as well. In the sense of you can't get overly specific in thinking about whom you're writing for, because then you just start writing things that you think will make those people happy, and I don't have to explain why that's bad news. That said, in some kind of cosmic sense, I'm very concerned with who's out there and in whose hands this book might land. I'm not writing. I'm writing for myself, of course. But I'm also writing because I hope that the book will reach people, and that even if we never get to have the conversation live, I hope we have some kind of silent conversation where what I think I put into the book and what they think they're sort of feeling and processing as they're reading it, even if they're 3,000 miles away. And that balance is so hard to maintain. I don't know that I ever ask myself explicitly, Boris, will somebody care about this? It sort of becomes a kind of a muscle that gets bigger and bigger with time. You sort of develop an instinct for some invisible person, some invisible entity that you're writing for, but they're there in my heart, or wherever they're located, but they're there every step of the way. And somehow you answer 100, every writing session, you answer that question 100 times, which is, will anybody care? I don't know. But sort of all that happens somewhere behind, somewhere in the subconscious almost.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Boris Fishman. The book is A Replacement Life. One of the themes of this, which I always find is a fascinating theme, is sort of truth, what the fact versus truth versus, well, even in fiction, I think you can tell more truth than you can oftentimes in nonfiction. And there were some really great scenes with characters kind of challenging each other that, you know, from my point of view or from somebody else's point of view, this is a truth. I just thought that was it's one of those things that I'm always grappling with that this book brought out and really explored. I was wondering your thoughts on if you came to any different conclusions in writing the book about that notion that you didn't have before.
Well, if anything, the novel only fortified my conviction that outside a courtroom, it would be so great if all of us accepted how much blurrier the line between fact and invention really is. I mean, I won't speak outside sort of my line of work, but there's this way in which, and I won't even speak for others, I'll just speak for myself, there's a way in which I used to regard memoirs as fact and novels as fiction, 100%. And the mind does seek clear demarcations. It's just the way that we're wired. That said, memoirs invariably are reinterpretations of what happened. They're compositions. The dialogue is recreated. They're the author's earnest, most well-meaning effort to get at what actually went on. But you can bet your bottom dollar that its relationship to what really went on is often tenuous at best. Not for no motive. It's just what it means to write a memoir. Same, by the way, goes for perhaps, I don't want to call it more rigorous. I think memoirs are very rigorous. But even if we're talking about biography, Norman Mailer talks about this a lot. The way that biography is just, it's the historian's best effort to recreate what happened. At the same time, you pick up a novel like mine, as I'm discussing in this interview, so much of it is drawn, if not on actual things that happened, then on inspirations from real life. Real life models began the process. And so, I don't know, it feels much more exciting, much more interesting, and much more fertile to be confused rather than clear about where fact ends and fiction begins. So that really, as a former fact checker, I spent 3 years as a fact checker at The New Yorker, where understandably and reasonably there's this idea that facts are facts and non-facts are non-facts. I've spent the years since moving away from the strictness of that definition to what I ended up exploring in the novel.
Great. You also talked about the importance of specific detail to make the stories credible. And it was funny because there are excerpts in the novel of the invented narratives for these characters seeking restitution claims. And they're so compelling, you know, these stories that the Slava in the book was writing. And it is. It's all specific detail. I think when writers get lost, they need to go back to very minute, specific details that draw the reader in.
That's right. I mean, I got that from Garcia Marquez. He did an interview once with the Paris Review where he said, if you tell somebody there are elephants flying outside your window, nobody will believe you. But if you tell them there are 425 elephants outside your window, they'll think twice. And I think that's very true. When a concrete detail appears in a story, perhaps even a superfluous detail appears in a story. Talk about, you know, concision and economy are the holy grails of good writing. However, if you're misinforming, an unnecessary detail is actually the one that persuades the reader it came to feel like the story is true. Because who would add an unnecessary detail unless it were really true, you see? the Garcia Marquez example sort of set me free to think about, basically in the novel, Slava and I, Slava the young narrator, we're learning how to write a story at the same time. And so he's sort of giving me help, and I'm giving him help. And as we're figuring it out, I'm telling the reader everything that I'm doing. That's the other trick I came to feel of telling a good story. Show the scenes. Show your tricks. Make it seem like you're not hiding anything, and just tell the reader what you're doing exactly as you're doing it. For example, there's a scene between Slava, the narrator, and an investigator. And he is someone who, he's clowning around, but at the same time that he's joking, sort of, he's tightening the noose around Slava's neck. And while he's doing that, he's telling Slava that he has read that the best way for investigators to work is to joke around and then tighten the noose around the subject as they do it. And that's sort of an example of what I wanted to do.
That is so great. Oh, these hours go too fast. We're out of time. But this was a massive pleasure. Tell us where we can find you online, Boris.
I'm at borisfishman.com, and because my name apparently is ripe for misspelling, it also sounds like Morris and Horace and Forrest, which I get just as often. I'll spell it for you if you don't mind. B-O-R-I-S is the first name, and F-I-S-H-M-A-N is the last one. And if you go there, you'll find my links to Facebook and Twitter and all that. But that's sort of my home online.
Love it. Boris Fishman, thanks so much for taking the time this morning.
It was a great conversation. Thank you for having me. I so appreciate it.
Me too. That was Boris Fishman. The book, A Replacement Life, is out and available now. That's all the time we have for today. Nicole Nelson will be here next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Stay tuned for Sister Rue coming up next to bring you great reggae tunes. And stay with us next time, next Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. Until then, have a great day.